Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, Venerable Sir, you have given a very valid answer to the question as to why, while walking, it is not possible to do anapanasati. Okay? Similarly, it is possible. Is it possible or advisable to try to concentrate and expand the space between the thoughts to achieve stillness stillness in the sleeping position? What happens if you fall asleep in the process? Okay. Alright, let's see the last one first of all. We find this retreat extremely useful. Okay, I'm very happy to hear that. Not quite a bit of homework to be done. Okay. Maybe we suggest another retreat, maybe late next year. Okay. Well, that's very, very nice to hear these things. People are very, very happy, so that's good. Can you fall asleep while doing the lying down? Yes, certainly you can. So sometimes that's why lying down sometimes is not the best meditation posture. There was an interesting case of a Thai monk who visited Bodhinyana Monastery a few times, a very famous meditation master. And he was once asked what the best position for meditation was. He was rumored to be an arahant, so he was, you know, a bit ahead of most of us. But he said for him the best meditation posture was lying down. And people then said, well, don't you fall asleep when that happens? And he said, no, sleeping would actually be doing something. So he was, you know, by not doing anything, he meant not even falling asleep. So that was his answer to that one. So basically, it depends on the state of your mind, right? If the mind is very bright and very clear, and there's no sloth and torpor, then you can even lie down, and you can actually achieve good meditation in that way, by focusing on the space between the thoughts or whatever it is. But if the mind is not that clear and bright, of course, then there is a danger of falling asleep. So as in all things, you have to kind of figure out for yourself what works, right? This is always, in the end, you know, you have to sort of take responsibility for your own practice and see what works for you. We all are slightly different. Our minds work in slightly different ways. So you have to sort of look at yourself and see what you need to do for yourself. So let us try. Let's see what this one says. Dear Ajahn, the Lord Buddha gave some criteria to decide what is Dhamma and discipline in Kalama Sutta and to Venerable Upali, Gotami, etc. Can you put all together and comment upon these? Okay. Basically, I think what the Buddha said, I think to Upali was the most possibly lofty one, where he says that whatever leads to dispassion, viraga, nirodha, I think even he said nekama perhaps, and nibbana, sambodhi, upasama, calm, basically all the qualities that lead towards these very lofty things, calm, cessation, dispassion, fading away. I can't remember off the top of my head all the qualities, but all these lofty spiritual qualities, if you're heading in that direction, then you're doing right. The advice to Gotami was slightly different. I think there it was the qualities that lead to increase in energy, I think, more energy, more mindfulness perhaps, samadhi, basically spiritual qualities, right? So whatever leads to these things, I wish I could remember them off the top of my head, but unfortunately I can't. And then you have the criteria of what is Dhamma and discipline in the Kalama Sutta. The Kalama Sutta is slightly different, because there it is more about giving advice to non-Buddhists as to how they can recognize what is good teachings, good Dhamma, right? And then he says to the Kalamas, whenever you know for yourself that these things lead to wholesomeness, lead to good states, lead to decrease in anger and desire and increase in the other things, then it is a good thing. So it's a similar, you're right, there are similar things, and they're all about looking at what are the good states in life, what are the things that are really in accordance with the Dhamma, right? If they are, then you're heading in the right direction here. Yeah. I'm sorry, but that answer is probably a bit vague, but it's hard to remember all of these things just off the top of my head like that. Okay, anyway. So, is the understanding of suffering a right view? Yes, that's exactly right. That is a very important part of right view. Remember, right view is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. That's in the, in the end, that's what it's like. And a very important aspect of the Four Noble Truths is a full understanding of suffering. So that certainly is part of right view. But remember that sometimes we focus a lot on suffering, and that's how it's described in the suttas. But if you understand suffering, you also understand happiness, right? There are two sides of the same coin. So you also know what happiness is. And sometimes, I remember one of the teachings of the Buddha, he says that, I teach some people, he says, by teaching them about suffering here, because that's how you motivate them, get away from suffering here. I teach others by teaching about happiness, because they get motivated by happiness. Ajahn Brahma is like that, he always talks about happiness, that's what motivates him on the path. And then there are those who are motivated by both being taught about both suffering and happiness. And that's what motivates them. So it's good to, that's why it's good to vary the teachings a little bit, and then you can possibly draw in more people, because they can relate more to the topic. So suffering is right view, but understanding what happiness is also right view here. Okay. Venerable Bhante, your teaching has uplifted us. Thank you. May you attain Nibbana. From the retreat participants of Cottage 4. Okay, thank you, all participants of Cottage 4. I don't know who you are, but anyway, that's very kind of you. Okay. Next one. Dear Bhante, have you seen past births? If so, could you describe a few? Okay, that's a very optimistic question. Did you think I'm going to answer that one? Basically, the answer is that very few people have actually seen their past life. That's the first thing here. The chances that anyone would have remembered their past life is very small. Generally speaking, as monastics, you cannot actually say these things. So it wouldn't be appropriate for me to say either way. And if I had, it wouldn't be appropriate. And if I haven't, then I'm still sort of giving things a little bit away by saying that I haven't. So either way, it isn't really appropriate. That's it. Sorry about that. Okay. Venerable Bhante, in the great 40 Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 117, we had a look at that one this morning, very, very brief passage from that sutta. The Lord Buddha mentions the twofold right view. Is this mundane and supramundane right view? Similarly, are there mundane and supramundane states for any other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path? May you attain Nibbana with Sukha Patipada Kippang Abhinya. That means, may you attain Nibbana on the happy path with quick penetration. That's what that means. Okay, thank you very much for making the Noble Eightfold Path so explicit and meaningful. Okay, that's very happy to hear that. So, is this supramundane and mundane right view? Actually, the way it is explained in that particular sutta is unique to the entire Sutta Pitaka. It doesn't occur anywhere else. Venerable Analayo, the one who has been most in comparative studies, is a German monk, and is becoming very famous for his comparative studies because his skill with languages is quite phenomenal, so he can read all different languages and compare them together, Chinese, Tibetan, Sanskrit, Pali, and many other languages. And he has come to the conclusion that this is one of the very few suttas where there's Abhidhamma material that basically is found in that sutta. And if you look at the words that are used there, they're very similar to the things found in the Abhidhamma in that particular sutta. So either there has been later ideas of Abhidhamma have come into the suttas, or perhaps this is a sutta, one of the first suttas where the very beginnings of the Abhidhamma can perhaps be seen in that sutta. Perhaps we don't really know exactly what's going on. And there is a parallel sutta to this one in the Chinese, which is very different, and that does not have that Abhidhamma aspect in it. And these kind of things, when you compare them, then tend to point out that the Chinese version is likely to be more early or authentic, or which because it doesn't have this later Abhidhamma material. But basically, so that particular type of right view that is mentioned there is not really so interesting because it's not based on the suttas. But there is such a thing as mundane and supramundane right view. But really what that is really just the right view of the ordinary person versus the right view of somebody who is an Arya, somebody who has penetrated the Four Noble Truths. So that is really the important distinction. And the ordinary view of the Putujana, the ordinary person, is just the view that, you know, there is rebirth, there is karma, there are awakened beings in the world, right? These sort of things. One of the very interesting things in the right view formula, because since we're talking about this now anyway, is it says as part of this karma and rebirthing, it says there is mother and father. That's what it says in there. The interesting thing is there is mother and father. When you first read that, you sort of don't even see it because it's so obvious. Of course there is mother and father. It just doesn't make any kind of impact on you. But actually, what that means, I think, because it is part of the idea, it forms kind of group together with karma and rebirth. What it means is that mother and father is a place where you can make lots of karma, either good or bad, depending on how you behave towards your parents. So they are a very powerful field of merit, your parents. So if you want to make a lot of good merit, then treat your parents very well. You know, do the right thing to your parents. Don't kind of overdo it so you feel kind of worn down or whatever, but whenever you have the chance, do the right thing towards your parents. You can make enormous good karma that way. And we know from the suttas that killing your parents is one of the worst kind of karma that you can make. So basically it's quite clear in the suttas that parents are this very powerful field of merit. So this is one way of, if you want to enhance your store of merit, make sure you look after your parents in the right way. And the supramundane right view then is just the right view when you have penetrated and understood the Four Noble Truths, right? This is really what, in my mind, is the ordinary and the Aryan right view. Similarly, are there mundane and supramundane states for any of the other path factors? Yes, there would be, according to this sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya 117, there is. But again, because they have this kind of Abhidhamma flavor to it, I don't think that is the best place to look for this. The best place to look is, again, to look at the person who has right view in the supra, the person who is an Arya, and his way of practicing the other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path will be like the Aryan aspect of those factors, right? So they are like the supramundane, and the ordinary person's practice of the Noble Eightfold Path will be the ordinary ones. So we are all trying to approximate to the Noble Eightfold Path. We do our best. Because of the illusion, we are limited, whereas the Aryan will be practicing those factors more or less perfectly. So I hope you are okay with that answer. So let's try the next one. Dear sir, how can a lay person who is single choose a partner without breaking the third precept? It shouldn't be a problem. You are choosing the partner. Remember, breaking the third precept just means that you are not having any kind of extramarital affairs, right? That's basically what it means. Or you're not having what they call, you know, illicit kind of sexual relations with somebody. You know, somebody underage or somebody who's protected in a certain way or something like that. You know, this is basically what it means. So if you just have an ordinary relationship with somebody, you cannot really break the third precept. So that is fine, unless you mean the eight precepts. If you are referring to the eight precepts, of course, that is a precept you only keep when you go on retreat, right? That's the brahmacharya, where you have no sexual activity whatsoever. And of course, in that case, of course, you can't really have a relationship in the ordinary way. So no problem. You can choose a partner. That should be no problem. Okay. Next one. Dear teacher, someone said when a person dead, the four elements separate will very far apart, but some near-death experience puts on speak above the near-death experience like not same with it. Why? Which one is right? Okay. I don't understand this question, unfortunately, so I'm going to have to put it to one side. Sorry about that. So go on to the next one. Okay. Dear Ajahn, someone said if 7 days not take food, people will be dead. Is it sure or not? About Nirodha Samadhi, also talk about it. What is it? If someone does not take food for 7 days, will be dead. I don't think so. You hear about people doing hunger strikes all the time and they don't take food for 7 days. I think it can be done. If you don't drink for 7 days, you might have a problem. But I think not taking food is probably okay here. Nirodha Samadhi, what is that? I think what you're probably referring to is what is called Nirodha Samapatti, also called Sanya Vidayata Nirodha. What is it? Basically, it is a very profound state of meditation. You go through all the jhanas, you continue up through the immaterial attainments, and eventually you come to an attainment where everything just stops, everything ends, and there is nothing. That is Nirodha Samapatti. So it is a very, very profound. It's the highest kind of stillness you can have. When you come out of that one, usually you are an arahant, or at least an anagami, when you come out of that sort of state. That's how profound it is. You can imagine seeing everything stopping, right? Now that means you basically see non-self in a very deep way. Everything has stopped. There cannot be a self anywhere. Nothing exists permanently. Everything's ceasing. This is very, very, very profound thing. It's also a very happy state. It's one of the interesting things in one of the suttas, I think it's called the Bahuvedana Sutta, where it talks about all the different types of feelings. I think it's Majjhima 59 or something like that. Bahuvedana Sutta. And it talks about the different kinds of feelings, and it talks about the sensual desire. It goes through the jhanas, and it says for each feeling, this one is better than the previous one. So you come to the fourth jhana, it's better than the third. First immaterial attainment is better than the fourth jhana, and it continues up. And then it says that the cessation of everything is better than feeling anything at all, right? And this is one of those things which is so profound about the Dhamma. How can, first of all, you have the fourth jhana, which is just pure upeka, pure equanimity, which is more happiness than, or a greater pleasure, if you like, than the highest happiness in the world in the third jhana. That is already mind-boggling. It's very, very hard to understand, right? And then you come to cessation, complete cessation, and that's even more happiness, according to the sutta. So this is why the Dhamma is so profound, because the ending of everything is more happiness than when anything is there. This is what this is why Dhamma is so hard to understand. But you get an inkling when in meditations things start to become peaceful and simple, and you recognize there's more happiness, and you can imagine kind of extrapolating that into the into the extreme, and then you get some understanding of what is going on. Thank you, Bhante. I can never thank you enough. It was a very good time for me. Nice place, Dhamma teaching, meditation, practice, everything. Thank you again. Okay. Thank you for saying all these kind words. It's very nice. So, next one. Dear Bhante, I know how important a living teacher were for me, particularly as an example and encouragement. I doubt that I would have continued to to progress in the Dhamma without that support. But of course, the Buddha is our primary teacher. What are your thoughts on this? Yes, that is a very good point, and it's always about a balance, isn't it? It's nice to have the Buddha as a kind of final refuge and place, but unless you actually see the living example, you see somebody who kind of reflect the teachings, it's very difficult to arouse faith, because the suttas are they're just words, right? They don't actually have any qualities to them. You can kind of see the metta and compassion in there, but you see it even more when you see a person face to face. So it brings the Dhamma alive. So I agree with that. It's a very important point. It kind of encourages you when you see these real life examples. So the combination, I always found, the combination of the two is the most powerful thing here. You have the living example, which tells you that the Dhamma actually works, and then you have the real teachings, which kind of are behind that. And the real teachings means that this is a 2,500-year-old tradition, and that tradition is still alive today. And that combination together is very, very, very important. If you were to meet somebody on the street who comes up to you and say, "I am enlightened, but you know, I completely by myself, etc.," it's very hard to believe, right? It's much easier to accept it if somebody is part of a system that has been going for 2,500 years, that has produced enlightened beings quite regularly, and still does so today. It is more reassuring in a sense. If just some odd person on the street tells you they're enlightened, you're more likely to think they're crazy than you are to think they actually are enlightened. So, yes, indeed, I fully agree with you. It's important to have both aspects. And that's why we have the Buddha as a teacher, but you also have live teachers in the present day as well. And when you combine the two, and in particular when you see that the two match, that the teachings match, that the qualities match, that's when it becomes very powerful. Well, thanks for the clarity and depth of your teaching of the Dhamma. Okay, very, very good. Venerable Sir, what is your opinion of evidence regarding past birth collected by psychiatrists, collected by their patients during hypnosis? Is this a proof of rebirth from the realm of confidence to that of knowledge? Okay. I think that some of the evidence that has come out with some of the research that has been done concerning past lives, etc., some of the research is a very high quality research, and it actually qualifies as proper scientific research. It's not kind of on the fringe or anything like that. Well, it is on the fringe because science makes it be on the fringe, because they don't want to hear about these things. It's too radical for most of science, but it's, in terms of its quality, it's not fringe science. And some of the best research, I think, is that done by the famous Professor Ian Stevenson, who collected the stories of children who talked about past life. And then he checked out that information that those children gave with the evidence that was available on the ground, you know, whether these things could be verified or whatever. And that has been, by many people, has been said to be very high quality. Of course, there are many, many skeptics, and the skeptics are probably more, but we need to remember that these things, because they are not part of mainstream science, it is natural that people will be skeptical. This is just the way things are. Just like people have always been skeptical about things that have been outside of mainstream science. It has always been like that. And the classical cases I remember very well when I was studying science at, I can't remember exactly where and when, but I was studying science, and they talked about, you know, in the 19th century when they were thought they had all the ideas of physics were all coming together with the atoms and the kind of the electrons and protons and all, and the periodic table was being worked out and all these kind of things. And some of the physicists at the time, they said things like, "Oh, you know, we have it almost all worked out, you know, that there's very few problems left. In a few years' time, science will be finished, and we will have it kind of all nicely sorted out," right? And this is kind of the blindness of science. They don't actually see themselves very clearly. They don't understand the limits of the scientific approach. Soon after that, you had relativity theory with Einstein, you had quantum mechanics, and the world of physics was kind of turned upside down. And so science is always evolving, always changing. And there are certain areas where science is strong and other areas where it is quite weak. And when it comes to the understanding the mind and the brain and the relationship between the two, science is still very, very weak in that area. It's working on it, and maybe one day we will have more clarity about this, that those things, and that would be great. Whatever that evidence shows, we will have to take that into account in our how we live our lives. So is it proof of rebirth? It's hard to say whether it's proof or not. It certainly is an indication that we're moving in that direction. The hypnosis, I think often the hypnosis is more uncertain. I think the Ian Stevenson's work, in my opinion, is more is better scientific work. The hypnosis thing is much more, there's much more doubt, in my opinion, concerning that, whether it really is past lives or whether it's just people, thinking and remembering things. I'm not so sure about that one here. Okay, what does vibhava tanha mean exactly here? Okay, vibhava tanha is the desire to be extinguished, not to exist anymore. That's really all it is. And you will find in the world that people usually have either they have the tanha they want to exist, or they want to stop existing. Yeah. So vibhava tanha is the desire, I've had enough of this life, I don't want any more, I want to just, when I die, I want that to be the end of everything. Yeah. And from that vibhava tanha, you get the views about annihilationism, right? That things cease, things come to an end after you die. It's a materialist kind of view. Huh? So that is vibhava tanha, but it's a type of craving. Yeah? So the paradoxical thing is that even though you want to make an end of everything, yeah, because that is a craving, it is actually a type of craving that leads to rebirth. And that is the paradox with vibhava tanha. I want to make an end, but unfortunately, that very desire drives you on into a new life. Okay, so next one. Dear Ajahn, I don't think we have enough time to discuss on dependent origination, but would you briefly explain on the third and fourth factor, vijnana and namarupa? Okay. Yes, vijnana and namarupa, the idea, these are, vijnana is just the consciousness as it exists in a new life, right? You come from the past life, the sankharas and conditioned vijnana gives rise to vijnana in the new life. And that vijnana, once it exists in a new life, depends on namarupa for staying at that particular place. You often talk about the stations of consciousness. So consciousness is like it's stationed in a certain plane depending on the kamma, right? This is what you find in the Mahanidana Sutta. There is different stations of consciousness. So you can be stationed in the kama loka or in the higher realms, etc. And that's where it will then stay for that lifetime. But it depends on namarupa, which then are the other mental factors and the physical form to actually remain there. And the simile used in the suttas is like two sheaths of reed leaning against each other. So if the namarupa falls away, consciousness passes away from that station of consciousness. If the consciousness falls away, the namarupa also disappears. So they actually rely on each other. So if you have a small, if in a case of the physical body being mortally wounded, then there's no basis anymore for consciousness to remain there, right? So consciousness then moves on into a new life. It can't exist without the physical body in the human realm. So they basically are completely dependent on each other. It's a mutual conditioning between namarupa and consciousness. That is the brief explanation. The long one is found in the Mahanidana Sutta on how these relate to each other. This is probably one of the most complex relationships in the dependent origination between these two. Okay, so what is the second arupajana? Okay, second arupajana is the base of infinite consciousness, right? That's what it says in the sutta. So it just means that you are aware of infinite consciousness. Anantang vijnanam, yeah. And that is your awareness. That's all you're aware of, this infinite consciousness. Very kind of, maybe infinite is the wrong way of putting it. It's like consciousness without limits, right? Limitless consciousness. I'm not sure if it is possible to, it isn't possible to see something that is infinite, but you don't see any boundaries. So it's boundless consciousness is basically what the second arupajana is. Okay. And the second question is, can one just focus on the question, for example, where did I come from, and then reach jhana or not? Can you focus on the question, where did I come from, to reach jhana? I don't think so. I don't think that's possible. I think if you ask the question, where did I come from, it's more like speculation about things, speculation about something that you cannot know. If you have a look at the Sabhasava Sutta, the second sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, it says in the Sabhasava Sutta that this kind of speculation, where did I come from, is precisely the kind of speculation that does not lead anywhere. It's the wrong kind of speculation, it's wrong view. Because you're assuming an I in the first place, right? Where did I come from? You're thinking about yourself in terms of an I. So anything like, where did I come from? Who am I? All these kind of questions. Where will I go in the future? What have I been? What will I become? All these kind of questions are mentioned in the beginning of the Sabhasava Sutta, and they are wrong because they're actually founded on the idea of an I. So this is definitely, when I look at it now, it's definitely not the sort of thing that you should be doing here. What you should be doing instead is just have a very simple meditation object, right? The breath, the metta practice, and just focus on that. And then, when you come out of a deep state of meditation, instead of asking questions like, who am I, etc., you should ask questions, you should look at the khandhas and see what the khandhas actually are. So instead of asking, who am I, you are looking at the khandhas to see whether there is any, whether they are permanent or not. And when you see that they're impermanent, then you realize there's no self there, right? So it's actually the opposite approach. This is the kind of question you should not really ask. And if someone focuses on one question, is it wrong or right samadhi? I'm not sure exactly what you mean by focus on one question, maybe what you mean is like contemplation of something, right? So if you want to do contemplation, contemplate something that leads towards samadhi. What is it that makes you peaceful? What is a contemplation that works? And usually the contemplation that leads to samadhi is a contemplation that makes you let go, right? When you let go, you become peaceful. Why? Because when you let go, the craving and the attachment go down. That's what letting go means. You're no longer holding on to things. So if you focus, for example, you do a little bit of death contemplation, or you focus on the suffering in the body, or something which shows you that these things are not worthy of holding on to, then when you let go of that, the craving subsides. When the craving subsides, the mind becomes peaceful. So this is how insight leads to samadhi, because it reduces the craving. So focus on whatever reduces the craving, and then you are on the right track. Still not samadhi, neither right nor wrong yet, but as it becomes peaceful, it can maybe turn into samadhi. Okay, dear Ajahn, some have said that it is essential to fully know and see dependent origination in order to become an arahant. Some say it is even necessary to fully know and see it, even to become a stream entry, sotapanna. Dependent on origination hasn't been mentioned by Ajahn in the retreat. How important is it to be successful on the path? Indeed, it is. When you become a stream entry, according to the suttas, you also understand dependent origination. But you don't actually need to focus on that teaching itself so much. It's not as if you have to check out all the different teachings and understand them all, you know, contemplate this one and contemplate that one. What you have to do is you have to see the five khandhas as impermanent, suffering and non-self. And the insight that you have as a consequence of that includes the insight into dependent origination. So you can focus a bit on the dependent origination if you want to, but it is just a consequence of the other insight you have when you see things deeply. So sometimes you don't need to focus on everything. You don't need to contemplate every teaching of the Buddha. Sometimes it's just to narrow it down, and the rest come as part of the package when you have the full insight. That's how I understand it. But indeed, yes, you do understand it when you become a stream entry here. Okay, I'm going to go a little bit fast, perhaps. Venerable Brahmali, the deepest gratitude to you for your kindness and compassion to us. May we be fortunate enough to have you as a teacher as we go on the path. The retreat was truly inspiring. May you have good health and happiness and tame nibbana. Okay, thank you very much for that. That is very, very good. Okay. I would recommend you to have the Buddha as a teacher. I'm not sure if, you know, I'm happy to sort of help you understand the word of the Buddha, but anyway. Okay, next one. Dear Adran, I know some place someone does meditation with eyes open. Is there any sutta said that you must have the eyes closed to meditate? Can someone reach jhana when they do meditation with the eyes open? I think having the eyes open is very distracting. I wouldn't recommend that. I mean, one of the things about meditation is to simplify things, right? And one of the most powerful impacts on the mind is precisely sight consciousness. The eyes take up about, 80% of the brain activity is related to the eyes. The eyes are very, very powerful, taking so much information through the eyes. So, I don't know about you, but when I close my eyes, you know, you start to feel peaceful already because you are blocking out so much information by just closing your eyes. So that is already a kind of peace because the amount of information is going down. That's also why you go to a place which is peaceful to reduce the sound impact, right? Because the less impact you have from the senses, the more peaceful the mind is. So to do meditation with the eyes open, to me, it sort of doesn't make any sense because you're actually going and not really becoming more peaceful that way. So it kind of contradicts the idea of what meditation practice is all about. Whether it is possible, it may be possible, if you have such incredibly powerful attention that you can focus on the breath and the sight just disappears even if your eyes are open. But you can imagine how difficult it is sitting there with your eyes open, focusing on the breath, and then the sight just disappearing that way. It's not easy to do, right? So that tells you it's probably wiser to close your eyes. Dear Adam, thank you for so skillfully guiding us through the wonderful retreat. This question is about being a Kalyanamitta. How do you gently yet surely guide others who are close to you, yet so far removed from the Noble Eightfold Path, towards at least right view? In particular, how can one accomplish this without appearing as a righteous person? Yes, that's a good question. The best way always to teach others is always the power of the example, right? Example is really what it's all about. When people see something inspiring, they get inspired. That's just the nature of things. I always think about myself, this was the question we had before. It's not enough to have just the teachings of the Buddha. You also need to have somebody to see, right? You see somebody who is inspiring here. And then when you see somebody who is inspiring here, that is when you actually feel the Dhamma comes alive. In the same way, if you want to inspire the people around you, you often need to make the Dhamma come alive through your own conduct. And if people see that you are growing, you are becoming more kind, more compassionate, more peaceful, then they will be impressed. And they will see there is something maybe here, something happening here. And the other thing, of course, is sometimes, if you have the opportunity, then you can take them to listen to a good Dhamma talk or read some good Dhamma teachings or whatever. Is everything okay? Is everything working? Okay, so take them to listen to something nice. Take them to listen to a good Dhamma talk, to an inspiring teacher. And sometimes that also, when they see somebody inspiring, then they may actually get some inspiration in their life. Again, it's about inspiring somebody. They must see that there's something there. When you see it's something there, then you will get inspired. One of the difficult things about family members and those close to us, because of attachment, we want them to follow the same path, right? And often it is because of attachment. And one of the things is that sometimes the people that are close to us are quite different from us. Sometimes they think differently. So because of that, it's important to realize that sometimes you cannot do anything here. You wish that your children would be, do the right thing, but sometimes they don't. And sometimes there's nothing you can do about that. So what you have to do in the end You can do your very best, you can try your hardest, you can try to be kind and compassionate, guide them in the right way. But in the end, if it doesn't work, you have to learn to let go and accept that they have their own personalities, they have their own karma, their own tendencies from their past. And because of that, they have to go their own way in the end. And there's nothing you can really do about that. And that is part of the suffering, I think, of having children, to see that they go their own way, do their own thing, and sometimes there's nothing you can do about it. So that is, I think that is the only way. And unless you learn, you do your best to teach them, and then if it doesn't work, if you cannot let go, then you're just creating suffering for yourself. So the best thing is to be an example, or to point out other examples, perhaps. Okay, dear teacher, is there any suttas mentioned about only finish the four jhana and then can do the arupa jhana? The question is whether it's enough to do the four jhanas. Is that the question? Whether finishing the four jhana is enough and that arupa jhana is not necessary? I'm not sure exactly what the question means, but I think perhaps maybe that's what it means. And certainly in the Noble Eightfold Path only goes to the four jhanas, right? So from that point of view, it is not actually necessary to do arupa jhanas. Arupa jhanas are like additional things. They are certainly can be helpful. They can, you know, they make you more peaceful, more calm, etc. So they can be very helpful. But they are not actually absolutely necessary. The fourth jhana is already powerful enough to take you all the way to full awakening here. Okay. Next question here is, if someone just focuses on nothing, 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 can you reach arupa jhana or not? By just focusing on that. Maybe you can. No, maybe you can. You can try that. The thing is that very often you try certain methods, and if you just focus on nothing, then it's great, right? It's good. So often it is in Buddhism, everything is measured by the result. If it gives result, then it is a good method. So try it out and see if it works for you. If you sit back and just focus on the mantra, nothing here, nothing here, nothing here, then it's good, right? So if it works, then use it. But usually, and I would always say that if you want to find the best type of meditation, then go to the word of the Buddha. What did the Buddha recommend? He recommends anapanasati, watching the breath. So that is the most powerful meditation method. To help that method out, if it doesn't work for you, try little mantras like peace, peace. Or if you like, nothing, nothing, if that works for you. Yeah, so again, it is neither right samadhi nor wrong samadhi in itself. It is, but it might lead you in direction of right samadhi if it works. Okay. Given the variety of cultures and society we know of today, if one were to look back over the eons of world contraction and expansion, shouldn't we expect to see everything from pre-agrarian and futuristic societies, i.e. those that were further along in the world cycle than we are in ours? Shouldn't this variety have been worthy of comment by the Buddha and subsequent arahants? The apparent lack of recognition of these social variations is one of my biggest obstacles to accepting the idea of past lives. It would, however, be a great tool for anthropologists. Okay. Is it worthy of comment by the Buddha and arahants? I'm not sure if it really is worthy of comment. Because, so what? You know, society may look a bit different. The heart of human beings will still be the same, right? It will still be obsessed by cravings and anger and all these kind of things. That is what really matters. The problems we face inside are still the same. We still have suffering, we still have happiness. That is what really is important. So we look back, and what we see is that essentially our psychological makeup is largely the same over the eons. So whether society changes or not, that is really quite an irrelevant thing here. But it is true, though, and I sometimes the suttas are a bit funny in that way, because they talk about the Dhamma always arising in Jambudvipa. Jambudvipa is the Indian subcontinent, and there is this kind of kind of inward lookingness in that particular sense. But when it comes to this, you know, these important suttas on the recollection of past lives, etc., I don't think there it is necessary to talk about such issues. They're really, as far as I'm concerned, are secondary, not really concerned with the heart of the Dhamma, which is quite different. Okay. I'm going a bit fast because we are running out of time a little bit. What is the difference between the Erkasinna and the first Arupajana? Okay, and someone said first Arupajana, something like dark blue Kasinajana. Is this right or wrong? I think maybe that is true. Probably you can use the Erkasinna maybe to attain the first Arupajana, because it is a similar kind of idea, right? The idea of infinite space. And so the space Kasinna perhaps. But again, these questions are very kind of lofty questions about very deep states of samadhi here. So I'm not sure about these issues. Okay. Some first Arupajana is something like dark blue Kasinajana. I don't know. Sorry. Can't answer that one. It takes an enormous amount of experience in meditation, I think, to be able to answer these questions. The relationship between the Kasinas and the Arupajanas, either enormous amount of experience in meditation, or you have to read all the commentaries, whatever, that discuss these things in detail. And I have neither, so unfortunately I cannot answer that question. So, most venerable sir, please explain that how to get into insight meditation after you come out of jhana. What is the difference between experience of entering jhana and the experience of becoming a sotapanna? Okay, so the insight meditation that you do after jhana is, which I spoke a bit about that yesterday in connection with the Anapanasati Sutta, and there it seems quite clear that what you do is you, after jhana experience, after samadhi experience, there's two things you can do. But the main thing is you look back on what happened during that process of arriving at jhana, because you see things disappearing, right? You see things changing, you see them fading away, and then nirodha ceasing completely. So that is a very powerful basis for insight. When something ceases, that is a very strong sign of impermanence. It cannot be you anymore. So you can see the non-self aspect of these things. The body, the senses, the will, a large part of feeling, a large part of consciousness and perception has disappeared completely. All you are left with is a tiny little narrow thing called the jhana experience. That's all that's left. So you can just, by just focusing on that, you can already gain a lot of insight. And the other way of gaining insight from a jhana experience is to contemplate the jhana itself and to remind yourself of the impermanence of the jhana experience. And these two things together is usually, according to the suttas, enough to actually lead you to full awakening here. So what is the difference between experience of jhana and sotapatti? Well, jhana is a state, right? It's a state you attain and you stay there for a certain period of time. And it also entails a lot of insight because many things have disappeared. So you know that many things cannot be a self and many things are dukkha. But stream entry is even further. When you become a stream entry, you see all the five khandhas, including the jhanas, as impermanent and non-self and suffering. So it's an experience that includes more. The insight is deeper, more profound. But the experience itself is of a different nature. It is not a jhana experience where you stay in a state for a long time. It's an insight experience. It's more like a flash, right, or something like that. And of course, afterwards you feel very peaceful, but it's not a state in the same way as jhana is a state. I don't know if that helps, but that is my understanding of these issues. Okay. Oh, okay. This is more about various upeka, brahmaviharas, and anapanasati for jhanas. I think I will leave these questions aside because I think they are a little bit too much and too much detail. And really, they are, I think, beyond the experience of myself and probably the vast, probably most people actually, to be honest. So I will leave that on the side if you don't mind it. Sorry about that. Okay, Venerable Metta Vihari, this is to you. Our deepest gratitude to you for organizing a retreat such as this, which will make us determined to travel on the path. Our appreciation to all those who have helped, including the Bandravela monks and those who gave dana. May you all attain Nirvana. Okay, there you are. You want to have that one? Huh? Sure, huh? Special one. Okay, so yeah, and we're describing the Buddha's teachings so we can understand easily here. It is wonderful because it has started from the gradual training until becoming an arahant, using not only the shorter discourse on the simile of the elephant's footprint, but with many other suttas in the canon. So thank you again, and much merit to you. Please forgive us if you have done anything wrong. For your inconvenience, please accept all the merit we have done throughout samsara. May you be happy and in peace. May you be healthy and long live. May you achieve your life ambitions. May attend Nibbana as you wish. It's a very kind note. And I think after this, we will probably do perhaps a little forgiveness ceremony and sharing the merits afterwards. So we'll do that afterwards anyway. Okay. So this question is, there are two kinds of concentration mentioned in Sanyutta Nikaya 45.1. Right concentration and wrong concentration. Is there a concentration which is neither right nor wrong? I think is the question here. I think, generally speaking, you would classify them into either one or the other. It's probably true to say that it can be more or less right or wrong, depending on the amount of right view you have. So the stronger your right view, the more right that concentration will be when you actually emerge from a jhana experience. And the stronger your wrong view is, the more wrong it will be. So probably it's true that there's like a grey area there. Things are never black and white, so there probably is like a grey area there. Okay, dear Venerable Sir, let me take this opportunity to thank you for taking the decision to visit Sri Lanka. I'm glad that monks like you and Venerable Ajahn Brahm are engaged in doing this great service by taking the message of the Lord Buddha to the world and the time presenting this profound Dhamma as a happy path. At the same time, presenting this Dhamma as a happy path. In my opinion, the path across the jhanas has gathered dust over a period of time, or at least has been sidelined. As a result, many alternatives have taken the center stage. With due respect to all those techniques, I think there is no reason for us to look for branches when the main tree is still available. It is a personal choice, though. As a layman, I realize that it will take a lot of commitment from us to get to the final goal. However, in my experience, the practice of letting go has made me wiser, more compassionate, and more forgiving. Wonderful. That's excellent. So thank you once again for coming all the way, and hope we will see you again in the not-so-distant future. May you enjoy good health and strength and courage to continue the good work. May you get the blessing of the Triple Gem. Also much merit to Venerable Metta Vihari and from the members, from all the members, from a wonderful job done. Okay, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Well said. It's interesting with the Dhamma. You're saying here that the jhanas have kind of gathered dust, and it seems like the world always goes through like periods, right? Things change, and in a certain period you neglect one aspect of the Dhamma, and then you have to balance it out, and then you neglect something else, and you have to balance it out again. And it probably always will be like that. You move back and forth, trying to find the middle way, right? It's very rare that you find a pure middle way, which is exactly right. We can never be complacent. We always have to investigate to make sure that we're actually practicing the right way. It's always dangerous to think, I have got it right, I understand. Always keep investigating to clarify your view, clarify the path. Dear Bhante, if time permits, please explain briefly the 10 perception described by the Buddha in the Venerable Girimananda. How can one integrate these things in the gradual practice? They are anicca, anatta, asubha, adinva, viraga, pahana, nirodha, sabbaloka, anavirata, sabbasankara, anicca-sanya, and anapanasati. Yeah. I think I'm going to have to leave that for perhaps next time when I come to Sri Lanka. This is a very, very big topic to discuss all these things, but it would maybe make a very nice sutta discourse, right, to discuss the Girinanda Sutta. It probably, if you want to discuss these things properly, you could probably go on for an hour or two at least. So I'm not sure if there is any point in just very quickly going over them. So please excuse me for skipping that now, and hopefully there will be a chance to do that in the future. But I agree, these are very interesting things, and it would be nice to do a sutta reading on that. Venerable Sir, thank you for coming to Sri Lanka, for sharing with us your mastery over and infectious enthusiasm for the suttas. We will henceforth be reading them in a new light. Okay, good. We hope the rest of your stay in Sri Lanka will be a pleasant one and that you will return to us in 2014. But no later than 2015. Okay. Good. Good. Okay. So that is the demand there. I have to come back by 2015. Okay. Well, that's very nice of you to say these things. I invite Ajahn Brahm back. He's the real master, you know. He's the meditation master who is really interesting to listen to because his depth of meditation is so strong. Anyway, can I go on, Bantanit, a little bit? Is that okay? Yeah? Just finish it off? Yeah? I promised I was going to finish off. No, I can go fast. So. Dear Bante, when something is offered to the Sangha, if a lay person touches it, does it have to be re-offered to the Sangha? Can you please explain the reason for this? Okay. Well, this is all about how you read the Vinaya. The Vinaya is a very complicated document because first of all you have the Vinaya Pitaka, then you have the commentaries, then you have the sub-commentaries. So it depends on what you take as the monastic Vinaya. Personally, I prefer just to read the Vinaya Pitaka, and I use the commentary to consult if there is a point which is uncertain. But I personally don't take the commentaries as binding. The word of the Buddha is binding. Everything else is optional. In fact, the Buddha himself said that you should not lay down new rules. So by taking rules from the commentaries, in a sense, you are laying down new rules. And that is not actually required or even right thing to do. So, if you practice purely from the viewpoint of the Vinaya Pitaka, if something has been offered, it does not have to be re-offered if a lay person touches it. However, if you practice according to certain commentarial ideas, then if it has been offered, then it has to be re-offered again afterwards. So this is all depends on how a monk or a nun practices the Vinaya. But what I would do, if I was a layperson, I would just be sensitive to the views of the monastics for where you are and respect the view of those monastics. Because it is not easy often to be a monastic and to decide in this jungle of rules what is right and what is wrong. So be respectful regardless. And if the monastic think that it needs to be reoffered, then do so. Just out of respect for that way of practicing. And if they don't think it's necessary, well, then that is okay as well. That is the best way to do it. Otherwise, we tend to sort of start to look down upon certain people and look down on others or whatever, and that is not a very good way of doing things. But I think in either case, whether you have it re-offered or not, in either case, that monastic is practicing the Vinaya properly, as far as I'm concerned anyway. Okay, dear Bhante, for everybody's knowledge, can you please explain a bit about the Theravada Tipitaka and how the commentary is formulated over time, if you have the time? Basically, the Theravada Tipitaka is itself like a very substantial thing. But if you talk about the Tipitaka, you have the Sutta Pitaka, the Vinaya, and the Abhidhamma is all there. And if you do, and this is one of the best ways of finding out what is the core of the teachings, is the idea of comparative studies. Compare it to the teachings of other schools, and what they have in common, that must go back to a common source, right? That is a very obvious explanation for why they have things in common. In fact, it is the only rational explanation. And if you look at that, it's very easy to find out what are the most ancient teachings. And those ancient teachings are found in the, basically, this is not 100% precise, but it is fairly precise. They're found in the Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanyutta Nikaya, and the Anguttara Nikaya. That's essentially where you find the teachings of the Buddha as they were given by him 2,500 years ago. I think that's probably all you need. And then the commentaries and many of the other things, they were created later on. And they arose as a consequence of the Sangha asking questions, trying to understand what the teachings are all about. And gradually they developed from that. I can't really go into this into detail because this is another very broad topic which you can talk about for a long time. Dear Bhante, can you please tell me how to explain the concept of rebirth to a Buddhist who has no conviction of being born again? If there is a sutta on this, please let me know which one. Okay, so the best sutta on this one is the sutta which really explains how rebirth works is the sutta in the Sanyutta Nikaya called the Kacchanagotta Sutta. It's the Nidana Sanyutta, sutta number 15, I think. And that sutta says that first of all, it says that the world divides usually into two views, either the views of eternalism or the view of annihilationism. These are the standard views in the world. So eternalism is like somebody who believes in a soul or a god and thinks the world, mind will go on or the soul will go on forever afterwards. The annihilationist is the one who thinks that everything will disappear when you die. It's like the modern materialism variety, right? So the world tends to focus on either one or the other. These are the kind of standard views in the world. But the Kacchanagotta Sutta says the reason why the eternalist view arises is because people have not penetrated the idea of things ending, of cessation. And the reason why the annihilationist view arises is because people haven't understood origination. So it is not understanding origination and ending of things that is what makes these views come into existence. But the middle way is to understand how things originate, how they cease. That is dependent origination, and that is understanding the idea of rebirth. So the idea of rebirth is basically about understanding that things arise from a cause. Things, as long as craving is there, things must arise again in the future. They cannot stop as long as craving is there. So that is kind of the classical sutta which talks about why there must be rebirth. It's basically through understanding the origination of things. There are also other suttas which talk about craving being the sap for beings being reborn in the future life. So craving is essentially a thing that drives the mind forward. It's as if craving almost projects the mind into a new life, basically. It's very hard, it's difficult to give an explanation because from the Buddhist point of view, it's based on insight, right? And that is what makes it so hard. Okay, thank you so much for explaining the sutta so beautifully. Much merit to you and to Venerable Metta Vihari for this retreat. We hope you visit Sri Lanka again in the near future. I never realized how sutras can be so inspiring. Okay, I'm very glad to hear that because that's exactly how I feel. So keep on reading a bit on your own and then gradually you will expand your understanding of the Dhamma. Two more questions. Okay, the gradual training and many other places in the Tipitaka speaks of the noble disciple, which is usually explained as a person who is at least a Sotapanna. But the Majjhima Nikaya 27 clearly states that when the noble disciple enters jhana, he does not yet come to the conclusion that the Blessed One is fully awakened. Okay, that's a good point, yeah? The Dhamma is well proclaimed, the Sangha is practiced in the right way. He comes to this conclusion only when attainment of arahantship. Why is this so? Shouldn't the Sotapanna have absolute certainty about the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, as skeptical doubt is no longer found in him, it being eradicated by the attainment of the first path. Yes. Yeah, that is. I think that's a good point. And I'm not sure exactly what is happening in the Majjhima Nikaya 27. I would also think that once you become a stream entry, because you have perfect confidence, you would basically know that the Buddha is awakened, that becomes clear at that point. It's a little bit strange how this sutta works, and how it actually, particularly towards the very end of it, is rather slightly unusual. One of the things to keep in mind, that is that the expressions used in the sutta, as expression like noble disciple, for example, they don't always have an absolutely precise meaning here. They don't always necessarily mean a stream enterer or an Arya. Sometimes they can mean also an ordinary person. Just a good ordinary person who is practicing in a good way can be called a noble disciple. So these terms have to be taken with a little bit of pinch of salt. They're not applied too kind of rigidly. This is the thing that you will find in many places of the suttas, that terms often have a technical meaning, very clear technical meaning, where they mean precisely one thing, but in other contexts they can be used more loosely, not necessarily with that technical meaning. One example is the word asava, which usually means the three types of asavas. And then you go to the Sabhasava Sutta, and there it is used much more loosely. And this, you find this throughout the Pali Canon. Generally I would agree with you. In the Chinese version of this particular sutta, the Chulahatipadopama Sutta, the Chinese version does not have that distinction between the Sotapanna and the Arahant. It just goes straight to the Arahant. Okay, very last question. Dear Ajahn, you are a living example of a real Buddhist monk. Yeah, we are blessed. Well, I'm going to have to live up to something now. I got to. the pressure is on. You know, no more messing around. Okay. Okay. Very good. So, thank you all very much.